Well, my guest graduated from the Tasmanian Conservatorium of Music back in 1987 with honours in composition. He's worked with the Tasmanian and Sydney Symphony Orchestras and the Australian Opera and Ballet Orchestra. He's performed with many jazz improvising groups committed to presenting Australian original music, and in addition has worked with international acts such as Lou Reed, Bobby Previtt, Jim McNeely, Jerry Lewis and Michael Bublé. He's a long-standing member of the Australian Art Orchestra and ARIA Award-winning world jazz group MARA, and is now finally about to launch his latest recording entitled Living, which we just heard with his string project. Paul Cutlin, welcome to Now's the Time.
Oh, it's so nice of you to have me along. Thank you.
We last chatted, Paul, back for Jazz and Beyond back in 2005 when you'd successfully completed the Birth of the Cool theatre production and concerts and recordings with Sandy Evans' Gestate. There's been a lot of water under the bridge since then, but before we chat about your latest recording, can you please share your musical background? Where did you grow up and what were your early musical influences and how did you discover the reed instruments?
All right. I grew up in Tasmania and I went to the conservatorium down in Tasmania when I got out of high school, and they only taught classical music at the conservatorium at that stage. I wanted to learn the saxophone, but they didn't teach that. So I decided to go with my first instrument, which was the clarinet. So I got a good thorough training in classical clarinet and composition, which I always wanted to do. So that really pushed me into the classical side of things for a while, and that was great experience. And that early experience with the orchestra down there, and then when I came up to Sydney, was really amazing. But I always knew in my heart of hearts that I wanted to pursue improvising. I wanted to get better at the saxophone, and, you know, I'd add a lot of different strings to my bow, and that's what ended up happening bit by bit and very informally, just learning from people that I met as I went along, doing club gigs and really small gigs. In original projects came later, but I just wanted to be a functional musician, somebody that earned money playing music, being useful, whether it was doing functions or, you know, weddings, that sort of thing, club dates. And then it gradually evolved into meeting some wonderful people like Tony Gorman and Sandy Evans and James Greening, and getting into that whole original music thing, which really had this amazing allure for me. So when I first came up to Sydney, I was going to the Soup Plus and joining in with the jam sessions there, honing my bebop chops and really getting into Coltrane and Parker and that sort of thing. And then going up to the Strawberry Hills and hearing the SEMA gigs and watching the Catholics and Wanderlust and Clarion Fracture Zone, Bernie McGann, and just soaking it all in before I eventually became part of that scene, which I guess happened about the mid-90s. Yes, so that was really, it was a slow journey for me. And I think more so because it took a while to develop that vision of what was possible for me and what I was good at. But it really was meeting the people and getting that feedback of people that were, that had faith in what I could do, especially people like Tony Gorman, who a lot of people may not remember now unless they're of my age, because he stopped performing about 20 years ago, really,
yeah.
Apart from his solo concerts. So multiple sclerosis stopped Tony Gorman from getting out and touring and being the prolific musician that he was. And now he gives these amazing solo concerts of his improvised music and the Monday Club.
The Monday Club continues. That's good to hear. Fast forward, I guess, Paul, and how did this string project, you know, how was it conceived? Because it brings together your background in working with strings in orchestras along with your talents as a composer, as well as that improvising aspect of your artistry.
Well, that's exactly it. I wanted to be able to compose for a group so I could hear some of my original music. But I also wanted to play with that group and improvise. And it took a while for me to figure out how to convincingly bring those sorts of music together. Because I used to listen to a lot of music, a lot of classical music, and read the scores and go out to concerts. But then I'd do jazz gigs and I'd improvise, and that's who I was. So, I did some study at the Sydney Con. I did a postgraduate degree and formed this string project, which has a string quartet, a double bass who improvises like I do, and myself. So six people. And the idea is I could write quite involved, classically, through composed music, and then leave a space where any of us could actually improvise. The string players as well, they're quite good improvisers. So that was about 2011-12, and then we brought out our first album, which was called Across the Top, which was inspired by my travels through the northwest of Australia, so the Kimberley region, the Pilbara, and through to Northern Territory. And that music was really trying to capture something of that red, ochre, dry, mysterious part of Australia that really had an impact on me. And that was at a time when I was touring there with the Mara Band back in 2007. And also back in 2000, we'd been through that area as well. And since then, I've been arranging more and more material for that group, a lot of it jazz standards or originals that I've arranged. And then I also composed a much larger piece called The 11th Hour, and that was inspired by the centenary of the end of World War One, and that was my next large-scale suite, about half an hour long. And I had all these pieces, you know, these jazz standards that I'd arranged, material by Jan Rutherford, material by Gary himself, Gary Daly. I was wondering how to bring it all together. So we recorded it at the beginning of the pandemic year, just before lockdown, and then I spent the rest of the year getting it edited and arranged into some sort of form so that it made an album. It out towards the end of the last year.
I was going to say, Paul, one of the appealing aspects for me of this particular recording is your willingness to record other artists' compositions. You mentioned Jan Rutherford there, but also Jenna Cave. Jan Rutherford, the late Jan Rutherford, was just a wonderful, not only a performer, but composer herself. What was your inspiration behind the idea of introducing other artists' compositions? Because I find it oddly rare in Australian jazz, actually, in improvised music.
You're right. It is rare, and it can be problematic when it comes to the point of bringing out an album, for instance. If you want to do everything correctly, for instance, there's a Coltrane piece in there, After the Rain. I found that dealing with John Coltrane's estates, what would you call them, the publishers, the copyright holders, was actually quite complicated. I had to submit my arrangement for approval. I had to pay quite a large fee to be able to use my arrangement, and then they get the royalties on top of that. So it is actually quite a complicated thing, sadly, to bring out a CD with songs by other people, unless they're out of copyright date. With the Jan Rutherford, that's a very personal connection because of my friendship with Jan. That was definitely worth doing. It's part of our history together. I wanted to celebrate that in music. And it was a lovely piece to arrange for strings. And with Gary, once again, he's a really close comrade. So I wanted to have a piece by him arranged and to actually involve him. So he's on the CD, as you know. Gary Daly plays piano on his own piece, as well as on the Jan Rutherford and on the Coltrane. And really brings a special guest appearance to the string project on the CD. Then when it comes to Jenna's piece, she had already asked me to write a piece for her Jazz Divergence Orchestra, which they premiered back in 2016, I think. It's called The Darkness of Silence. And they're going to be playing that quite soon, actually, in their next gig at Petersham Bolo, which I'm very excited about.
It's so just a beautiful lullaby, that Sleep in My Arms, isn't it?
Isn't it? So I asked her to write a piece that would reflect on her recent experiences of becoming a mother for the first time. So she wrote a piece called Sleep in My Arms, which is about rocking her baby to sleep, and it's an absolute joy to play.
And I recently noticed that you were described as a bass clarinet god on Facebook by a fellow musician. My guess is that you probably take a compliment like that with a grain of salt, Paul.
Well, it was very nice of that chap to write that. It's funny, when I first saw it, I thought he was saying bass clarinet good. I thought, oh, yes, thank you. That's very nice of you. When I reread it, I thought, oh, okay. Gosh. But you have to cop those kind of things on the chin. It's very sweet and very nice.
Yeah.
In Australia, there are a number of very amazing bass clarinet players, like Jeremy Rose is formidable on the instrument, only having been playing it for a few years. Aviva Endiva, I think, is her name.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Something like that. And she is an absolutely wonderful player of multiple instruments, including the contrabass clarinet. So just not alone, but it's nice that people enjoy what I'm doing. And people are getting to know that instrument so much better now.
Of course, the topic of the last 12 months has been COVID-19. In terms of the arts, what do you see as the lasting impacts of this pandemic on the Australian cultural landscape, Paul?
I don't know. I actually have no idea, because I think this year is going to be quite tough as well. It's going to be very cautious, and we're going to be taking baby steps as artists, as audience as well. And I think things are going to have to change, and there will be no return to whatever it was before. It's going to be something different. And I think a lot of people will find that they're out of an old job, but in a new job, hopefully. And a lot of us are going to have to reinvent the landscape, the artistic landscape. And there's going to have to be some pushback by audiences too, against the decimation of the arts. If they want the arts to be something, they want it to be there, they're going to have to fight for it, they're going to have to ask for it, they're going to have to demand it of government. Government are going to have to hear from the people that it's important, because it's last thing on their agenda. They don't think it wins them any votes, and they don't care. If they'll let the tourism sector sink and die, what chance does the arts have?
It's a sad state of affairs when it gets to that point. And an interesting comment from you in terms of how the landscape will change in terms of artists either out of a job or into a different type of job within the arts. Of course, early on in the piece, we saw a lot of Australian artists adapting to sort of online performance in their own lounge room, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you know, the ability for viewers to sort of participate in a limited type of way online with that thing. But I don't see it as a viable alternative or even a viable experience in terms of a cultural artistic experience.
No, it's a supplement only, and it doesn't, I don't think it makes anybody any money either.
No.
So it's a bit of a lose-lose, but it's something.
Yeah.
And I did my fair share of it last year. I think that there'll be a lot more proactive activity from artists to try and make different things happen, small scale, contacting their audiences more directly. I also think that the idea of going out and hearing music is going to become more precious. And you already see people paying more money for the opportunity to go and see quality music for a short amount of time and then go home. That's not good for people with not much money, though. So that's one thing that's happening, I'm seeing. And I think it's very difficult for the venues. I think the venues like 505, et cetera, really deserve a lot of support because they're not getting any money from the government to help them pay the rent while they accept smaller audiences, you know. So they've got really reduced capacity, and I fear for these venues, I think.
Paul Cutland, congratulations on this album. It is a fine one. It's called Living, the Paul Cutland String Project. Walk us through briefly about this particular track, Living.
Living starts with our percussionist who comes from Queensland. Tunji Baya is a wonderful exponent of Indian percussion, and he's playing the cajon, which is actually a South American instrument. Living is just that, one of those really ebullient, optimistic tracks that just makes you realise it's all worthwhile.
Paul Cutland, thanks very much for joining us and all the best for the gig on Sunday.
Thanks so much, Frank.